Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Your reader will be Paul Hinkle. Your articles will come from the New York Times Technology section. Article number one. When the AI professor leaves, students suffer, study says. For years, big tech companies have used huge salaries, bonuses, and stock packages to lure artificial intelligence experts out of academia. Now a study released on Friday says that migration has hurt the post-college prospects of students. The study, the first of its kind, was conducted by researchers at the University of Rochester. They found that over the last 15 years, 153 artificial intelligence professors in North American universities left their posts for industry. An additional 68 moved into industry while retaining part-time roles with their universities. This migration has greatly increased in recent years, the study said. From 2004 to 2009, 26 university professors moved into industry. In 2018 alone, 41 professors made the move. The steep rise in departures over the last decade and a half indicates that the trend will continue. The talent shift could accelerate the development of artificial intelligence inside tech giants like Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Apple. But at the universities, the professors left, graduating students were less likely to create new AI companies. When they did, they attracted smaller amounts of funding, according to the study. The effect was most pronounced in the field of deep learning, a technology that has become a crucial part of new AI systems. In time, the brain drain from academia could hamper innovation and growth across the economy, the study argued. The knowledge transfer is lost, and because of that, so is innovation, said Michael Goffman, a finance professor at the University of Rochester and one of the authors of the study. Deep learning is driven by neural networks, complex mathematical systems that can learn tasks by analyzing vast amounts of data. By pinpointing patterns in thousands of dog photos, for instance, a neural network can learn to recognize a dog. Until 2010, the tech industry largely ignored the idea. But as the internet generated more data and new computer chips reduced the time needed to analyze it, the technique started to make more sense for the companies that had all the information. Machine learning helps AI systems perform tasks like recognizing photos, identifying spoken words, and translating languages. It also helps self-driving cars recognize objects and make decisions. Big tech companies have hired many of the academics who specialized in the technique. Three longtime academics recently won the Turing Award, often called the Nobel Prize of Computing, for their work on neural networks. Two have moved into industry, one to Google and the other to Facebook. The tech and automobile industries have aggressively pursued the idea of a driverless car, drawing another wave of academics out of the university. In 2015, Uber hired 40 people from Carnegie Mellon Robotics Lab, including research professors. Since then, industry interest in artificial intelligence of all kinds has increased, according to the study. Google and DeepMind, both owned by Alphabet, have hired 23 professors. Amazon has hired 17, Microsoft has hired 13, and Uber, Nvidia, and Facebook have each hired 7. Tech companies disagree with the notion that they are plundering academia. A Google spokesman, for example, said the company was an enthusiastic supporter of academic research. We've given over $250 million to academic research since 2005. And every year we host over 30 visiting faculty. Dozens of PhD students and thousands of interns, said the spokesman Jason Fredrentfields. He said many professors went to work at Google and returned to their university positions. The study found that students most affected by the departures were those who graduated 4 to 6 years later, meaning they probably had little interaction of the departing professors. At any given university, a significant increase in the number of departing professors reduced the number of AI entrepreneurs by 13%. The impact was particularly notable at top 10 universities and with entrepreneurs who completed PhDs. Some experts worried that as top professors move into industry, the education of the next generation of students will suffer. If industry keeps hiring the cutting-edge scholars, who will train the next generation of innovators in artificial intelligence? Ariel Procaccia, a computer science professor at Carnegie Mellon, said in a recent op-ed piece for Bloomberg. At Carnegie Mellon, 17 professors, all of them tenured, have moved into industry, the study showed. Some were part of that mass hire by Uber. The University of Washington and the University of California, Berkeley, each saw 11 make the move. The Rochester study did not directly analyze the quality of the training students received after these professors departed. Instead, it focused on the startup company, showing that that departures led to fewer students' startups. When professors left universities and were replaced by professors from lower-ranked schools, students were even less likely to create a startup, the study said. Experts are split on whether a decline in the startup economy will harm the progress of AI. Just because students are not starting their own firms does not mean they are not going to work in AI, said Joshua Graf-Ziven, a professor of economics at the University of California, San Diego. They just may be doing this in other ways. But many agree that university funding should be increased to ensure that the next generation is properly educated. Machine learning and artificial intelligence is one of the most exciting and rapidly expanding fields in science, said Scott Stern, a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Business. We need to make sure we are investing in the seed corn. Article number 2. India loses contact with Chandrayaan-2 moon lander during its descent. The country will probably have to wait for a future mission to join the elite clubs of nations that have landed on the moon. India's attempt to land a robotic spacecraft near the moon's south pole on Saturday appeared to have ended in failure. The initial parts of the descent went smoothly, but less than 2 miles above the surface, the trajectory diverged from the planned path. The mission control room fell silent as communications from the lander were lost. A member of the staff was seen patting the back of K. Sivan, the director of India's space program. He later announced that the spacecraft was operating as expected until an altitude of 2.1 kilometers or 1.3 miles. The data is being analyzed, he said. The partial failure of the Chandrayaan-2 mission, an orbiter remains in operation, would delay the country's bid to join an elite club of nations that have landed in one piece on the moon's surface. If the spacecraft crashed, although a communications glitch was also possible, it occurred during a period that Dr. Sivan had called 15 minutes of terror. A series of steps had to be completed by computers on board the spacecraft in the correct sequence with no opportunity for do-overs. This was the third attempted spacecraft landing on the moon this year. In January, China landed the first probe ever on the far side of the moon. The lander and accompanying rover have been operating since then. An Israeli nonprofit sent a small robotic spacecraft named Bereshit to the moon, but its landing attempt in April went awry in a manner similar to Chandrayaan-2. The initial descent went as planned, but then communications were lost near the surface. It was later discovered that a command to shut off the engine was incorrectly sent. Chandrayaan-2 launched in July, taking a long, fuel-efficient path to the moon. Earlier this week, the 3,200-pound lander named Vikram, after Vikram A. Sarabhai, the father of the Indian space program, separated from the orbiter and maneuvered toward the moon's surface. 15 minutes before the planned landing, the Vikram lander was traveling at more than 2,000 miles per hour at an altitude of about 20 miles. Four of its engines fired to quickly slow it down as it headed toward its landing site on a high, flat plain near the South Pole. Later in the landing process, it appeared that Vikram was descending too fast, and then data from the spacecraft ended. The moon is littered with the remains of spacecraft that have tried and failed to land in one piece. Two American craft from the Robotic Surveyor series that helped blaze the trail for Apollo crashed in the 1960s. Several probes from the Soviet Luna program also collided with the moon's surface. The makers of the Beresheet and Chandrayaan-2 both noted the low cost of their missions, $100 million to $150 million, which is much cheaper than those typically launched by NASA and the European Space Agency. NASA is currently trying to tap into entrepreneurial innovation for upcoming robotic moon missions. The first of these low-cost trips is scheduled to launch in 2021. The outcomes of the Indian and Israeli missions highlight that lower costs can mean higher risk of failure, which NASA will need to adjust to as it pursues a lower cost approach. While India may not have stuck the landing on its first try, its attempt highlighted how its engineering prowess and decades of space development have combined with its global ambitions. It remains to be seen what the crash will mean in India's domestic politics. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, the country's national leader, has embraced the country's space program to raise India's brand on the global stage and make Indians feel fired up about their nation's growing strength. This is all about national pride, said Pallava Bagla, co-author of a book about Indian space exploration and a dedicated space journalist. Applause swept through viewing parties in Bangalore for most of the lander's ascent. At the command center, scientists rose to their feet as they tracked the mission's progress. When communication was abruptly lost, Saitha Narayanan, 21, an educator with Astroport, a group in Bangalore that spreads awareness about astronomy, said her heart dropped. At this point, it is a partial failure, he said. We will push until the end. While the mission may briefly soften the muscular nationalism espoused by Mr. Modi, whose government is already facing challenges from job losses and international criticism of his recent moves in the disputed territory of Kashmir, the Prime Minister tried to reframe Saturday's landing attempt as an opportunity for improvement in brief remarks after the contact was lost. Hours later, and back at the Space Center in Bangalore, the Prime Minister greeted the scientists, engineers, and staff of the space agency after delivering a motivational speech that was broadcast nationally in India. He stopped short of stating explicitly that the lander had failed. We came very close, but we will need to cover more ground in the times to come, he said. Later in his address, Mr. Modi added, as important as the final result is the journey and the effort. I can proudly say that the effort was worth it, and so was the journey. Space has become a popular topic in India. In some Indian cities, posters for Chandrayaan-2 have been plastered on giant billboards. School children in space classes are launching rockets made from empty plastic soda bottles. In July, when India sent up the rocket carrying the lander, millions watched the live broadcast of the rocket cutting into the sky on the top of a funnel of fire. The moon mission has been years in the making. For ISRO, India's version of NASA, founded in 1969 when components of rockets were transported by bicycles and assembled by hand. Hundreds of millions of Indians still live deep in poverty. India's philosophy is that space development can be used for human development. Its satellites help predict storms and save countless lives by sending out early warnings. And it hopes future business opportunities in space will create more work that lifts up more Indians. While the landing may have failed, India could try for the moon again, and it also plans to build future robotic explorers headed for Venus, Mars, and the Sun. In the next decade, it intends to send Indian astronauts into Earth orbit aboard its own spacecraft for the first time. Article number 3. Overlooked no more. Alice Guy Blachet, the world's first female filmmaker. Even before women had the right to vote, Blachet, in her actions and in her films, expressed female drive, desire, and self-determination. In 1911, the Moving Picture News wrote that Alice Guy Blachet, the first female filmmaker in history, was a fine example of what a woman can do if given a square chance in life. Blaché had already founded a successful film company in the United States by the time the article was published, announcing a new studio she was opening in New Jersey. She soon built that studio, adding to her triumphs. Cinema was Blaché's passion. She called it her Prince Charming, and it took her across continents and centuries in a life shaped both by soaring achievements and by some of the same struggles that women movie makers face today. She was aware of her singularity. "I have produced some of the biggest productions ever released by a motion picture company," Blaché told the Entertainment Weekly, the New York Clipper, in 1912. She made, directed, produced, or supervised, often doing triple duty, about 1,000 films, many of them short, the standards of the time. She would later leave the industry at a time when her life was marred by personal and professional disappointments, then spent years trying to claim her place in the very history that she had helped to make. Like other trailblazing women from cinema's formative years, Blaché has been discovered, somehow overlooked, and rediscovered anew, only now largely because of the feminist film scholars who are writing women back into history, does her place seem secure. Blaché got her start in films when she was 22 and working as a secretary in Paris for Léon Gaumont, an inventor who had begun manufacturing motion picture cameras. To demonstrate them to clients, his company made short films that Blaché thought could be better. "I had read a good deal," she wrote in the memoirs of Alice Guy Blaché, which was ushered into publication posthumously in 1976 by the historian Anthony Sickle, "and she had done some amateur theatricals. She asked Gaumont if she could film a few scenes. It seems like a silly, girlish thing to do," Gaumont told her, Blaché recalled from many decades later in a French television interview, "but you can try it if you want, on one condition, that your office work does not suffer." Armed with cameraman, an actress, and a painted backdrop, she made La Fille aux Choux, The Cabbage Fairy, in 1896, her first film. A pantomimed one-minute charmer, it shows a young woman who, with a smile and a bosom wreathed in flowers, plucks squalling naked babies from a cabbage patch constructed out of wood. Some historians believe that Blaché's inaugural effort was Sage Femme de Première Classe, First Class Midwife, her 1902 remake about a young couple who go shopping for a baby. Gaumont soon made Blaché the head of film production of his company, where she produced and supervised hundreds of films, helped create an organized studio system years before Hollywood was a company town, and trained luminaries of the art like Louis Fulod. When she moved to the United States, where she resumed her film career, her time at Gaumont was touted in profiles. In 1912, the trade journal The Movie Picture World wrote, "She inaugurated the presentation of little plays on the screen by that company some 16 or 17 years ago." Alice Ida Antoinette Guy was born in Saint-Mandé on the eastern edge of Paris on July 1, 1873. Her parents, Marie and Émile Guy, were French but lived in Chile, where her father was a bookseller. Marie returned to France for Alice's birth and left the child with a grandmother. 3 years later, Marie returned for Alice and they sailed to Chile. While passing through the Strait of Magellan near Chile's southern tip, as she recalled in her memoir, she conjured up fairies and beasts on walls of ice, an early whimsical prelude to her screen reveries. Assorted tragedies in Chile followed, and the Guys eventually returned to France, but over time the family disintegrated, leaving Alice to support her mother. Much of Alice's early years seemed to prepare her for a life in cinema, filled as they were with adventures, deprivations, and moments of fortitude. In her first secretarial position in an all-male factory, she recalled she boldly stood up to a sexual harasser. "My youth, my inexperience, my sex," Blaché wrote of her entrance into movie making, "all conspired against me. But she was hardworking and tenacious and would prove to be prolific." In 1894, she talked Gaumont, then the second in command at a photography company, into hiring her. Not long after, Gaumont formed his own company, and Blechet became a pioneer making films that were colored by hand and others that used a pioneering sound system, which synced visuals with pre-recorded wax cylinders. Blechet can be seen in one clip starting a phonograph while she directs both the cast and the crew. Among her Gaumont titles are La Femme Collante, a risque charmer about a maid with an amusingly sticky tongue, and La Matelée Alcoolique, about a peripatetic mattress with a drunken man sewn into it. In 1907, she married Herbert Blechet, another Gaumont employee, and resigned as head of film production to accompany him to the United States, where he was sent to promote Gaumont's Sync Sound film system. The undertaking was a bust, but in 1910, 2 years after giving birth to their daughter Simone, Alice Blechet formed the Solax Company and began making her own movies. She was so successful that in 1912, the year she gave birth to their son Reginald, Blechet built her own state-of-the-art studio in Fort Lee, New Jersey, then a bustling film town. She kept up a heroic pace at Solax. She would jump in her car or on a horse to scout locations, including an orphanage, an opium parlor, night court, and Sing Sing prison, where she declined the invitation to witness an execution. She supervised other directors and assistants, oversaw a stock company of adult and child actors, and corralled a menagerie of animal performers, among them rats, lions, panthers, and a 600-pound tiger named Princess. On one studio wall, she hung a sign that said, "Be Natural." Her interest in realism as well as performance dovetailed with what her biographer, Alice McMahon, said was Blechet's greatest achievement. Her films, McMahon said in a phone interview, focused on the psychological perspective of the central characters. Blechet told the Clipper in 1912, "I have always impressed upon my associate directors that success comes only to those who give the public what it wants, plus something else. That's something else I would call our individuality, if you please." Blechet expanded her repertoire at Solax with the cowboy films like Two Little Rangers, which features a pair of gun-toting heroines, one of them a girl with long curls who backs a villain off a cliff. Whether or not it was feminist by design, the film was feminist by default. Blechet wondered if women were ready for the right to vote, but in her actions and in her films, the expressed female drives, desires, and self-determination are all obvious. At Solax, she successfully made the transition to feature filmmaking, creating longer, more narratively complex titles that were well-received, though they were also entailed higher production costs and longer preparations. Yet while Blechet navigated the shift to features creatively, she didn't want whether the seismic changes affecting the fast-growing movie world, including monopolistic distribution practices. By 1914, she and Herbert Blechet had joined forces with another enterprise for which they both directed. The last chapter of Blechet's filmmaking career was marred by setbacks and disappointments, both in her new ventures with her husband and as a director for hire. She made The Ocean Waif, a touching romance about an abused young woman, and a writer that gives almost equal weight to both. Other films followed, but by the time she directed the well-regarded Her Great Adventure, Blechet was struggling with her health, financial difficulties, and a broken marriage and continued industry upheaval. She declined to direct the Tarzan movie. In 1922, the Solax studio was auctioned off, and Blechet, now divorced, returned to France with her two children. In France, she tried to find film work with no luck. It's unclear why she didn't succeed, although by the 1920s, the movies were a big business and no longer as hospital to women who wanted to make their own films. She sold her books, paintings, and other possessions and wrote articles and children's stories. She and her daughter, who worked for the American Foreign Service, spent the last years of World War II in Switzerland, where Blechet began writing her memoir. She also tried to find her films, but most were unavailable and presumed lost. She nevertheless persevered, gave interviews, and in time gained some recognition for her pioneering role in cinema. Blaché wrote of her life, "It is a failure. Is it a success? I don't know." She died on March 24, 1968, in a nursing home in New Jersey. She was 94. In 2012, the Fort Lee Film Commission installed a new gravestone for Blaché. The original one had noted only her name and the dates of her birth and death. The new memorial states that Alice Guy Blaché was the first woman motion picture director, the first woman studio head, and the president of the Solax Company, Fort Lee, New Jersey. The memorial is also adorned with the Solax logo, an image of the sun rising on a new day. And in our last article for today, Tim Ferriss, the man who put his money behind psychedelic medicine. The author of The 4-Hour Workweek is behind a surge in funding for clinical research into psychedelic drugs. The announcement on Wednesday that Johns Hopkins Medicine was starting a new center to study psychedelic drugs for mental disorders was the latest chapter in a decades-long push by health, nonprofits, and wealthy donors to shake up psychiatry from the outside, bypassing the usual channels. "Psychiatry is one of the most conservative specialties in medicine," said David Nichols, a medicinal chemist who founded the Hefter Research Institute in 1993 to fund psychedelic research. "We haven't really had new drugs for years, and the drug industry has quit the field because they don't have new targets in the brain. The field was basically stagnant, and we needed to try something different." The fundraising for the new Johns Hopkins Center was largely driven by the author-investor Tim Ferriss, who said in a telephone interview that he had put aside most of his other projects to advance psychedelic medicine. "It is important to me for macro reasons, but also deeply personal ones," Mr. Ferriss, 42, said. "I grew up on Long Island and lost my best friend to a fentanyl overdose. I have treatment-resistant depression and bipolar disorder in my family, and addiction. It became clear to me that you can do a lot in this field with very little money." Mr. Ferriss provided funds for a similar center at Imperial College London, which was introduced in April, and for individual research projects at the University of San Francisco, California, testing psilocybin as an aid to therapy for distress in long-term AIDS patients. The spiritual father of psychedelic medicine was the chemist Albert Hofmann, who discovered the effects of LSD in 1943 after accidentally ingesting it while working at the Swiss firm Sandoz. Dr. Hofmann had at least one bad trip. Everything in the room spun around, and the familiar objects and pieces of furniture assumed grotesque, threatening forms, he wrote afterwards. But he also recognized his problem child, as he called the drug, as a potential therapeutic agent. So did a host of prominent doctors at the time. Beginning in 1960, the renowned Scottish psychiatrist Dr. R.D. Lange gave LSD to patients, some with psychotic disorders, and it used it himself. Through the 1960s, other prominent psychiatrists experimented liberally, including Dr. Stanislav Grof, Dr. Humphrey Osmond, and Dr. Abram Hoffer. That's it for Tech Talk for this week. Join me again next week. This has been Paul Henkel.